Welcome to the BookTree podcast. What should your kids and teens be reading next? To answer that question, we'll be interviewing authors and illustrators, publishers and literacy experts, and other bookish people. We'll also look at current book news and trends and discuss issues around reading and writing. We'll look at the most burning question on all our minds. How do we get kids to read in these screen-obsessed times? Hosted by me, Corinne Rosmarin, journalist and writer. This is a home for all things books, children's and parents' books. After all, children become readers when they see their parents reading too. Come and join us, and let's find out what your kids and you should be reading next.
Welcome to the BookTree podcast.
Today in the studio, we've got Lerato Trock, the new director of Nali Bali, which is a national reading for enjoyment campaign that sparks children's potential through storytelling and reading. Lerato is an experienced early literacy expert with over 20 years of experience in publishing, writing, editing, translation, and story development. She began her career in the best place, the library, as a children's librarian, and she has worked on hundreds of projects since then. She has received awards for her translations and editing work. She has facilitated writing workshops internationally and presented papers on children's literature. She is also the accomplished author of children's picture books and young adult biographies. It is her passion to promote literacy and advance African publishing. Welcome, Lerato.
Thank you, Corinne. I'm very glad to be here, and I'm very excited to be a part of Nali Bali. I've only been here for 3 months, but it feels like 3 years already. But you know, Nali Bali is a very, very much loved South African literacy promotion campaign and NGO that we basically work for children 0 to 6 year olds and 6 to 12 year olds. That's our focus. And we mainly want to focus on the love of reading. You know, there are a lot of other projects that deals with education, with other methods of reading for school. And so for us, we want to focus on reading for enjoyment. That's why we are called the Reading for Enjoyment campaign, because we think that it starts there. You know, for you to transition to loving books as in schools, you need to start with loving stories first. I'm actually a prime example of that, because I didn't grow up in a home with books. My mother was not literate, but she gave us the gift of oral storytelling in Setswana. She was avidly telling her stories in Setswana every single day with no fail when I was little. So I grew up with that. That was the foundation of me loving books as I was, you know, going to school and reading and so on. So that's basically what Nali Bali is. So I've come full circle from that child who loved storytelling from her mother to being a leader of this organization that promotes the love of reading for enjoyment. So that's what we do. And we focus on children's literature in African languages mostly.
I love that. And what does Nali Bali stand for?
So Nali Bali is an isiXhosa word that means here's a story. That's what it is. And it's because I said, yes, a story. So that's why we are about stories. So here's the story. We give you stories.
And all children love listening to a story. You know, a lot of people talk to me about the literacy crisis in South Africa, and they sort of bandy about those terrible stats that came out. You know, I think it's about 81% of grade 4 learners cannot read for meaning. And, You know, I say terrible stats because really to have an education in any country, you have to be able to read. You can't progress. You can't read for meaning. It's like being stopped before you've even started. Does Nali Bali look at that at all? Are you focused on that? Or do you believe that the work that you're doing will answer part of that problem?
Well, it's very important. I mean, we are part of the whole ecosystem of reading. So we don't work, you know, in a silo, you know, because we only concentrate on reading for enjoyment. This is not our problem. All of us in the country, all parents, all races, all whatever, it's our problem. It's our challenge. We can't take ourselves out of that and say that's not what we are doing. Listen, it says without meaning. It means that children just take a book and read and they don't know what they are saying.
Yes.
And that is exactly what Nali Bali is for. Because for us, it's like read for enjoyment. So it means that when they don't read with meaning, then they're not enjoying reading. It's just because somebody, an adult has put a book in front of me, I'll just read because they want me to read. So if they're going to be reading without meaning, it means they're not enjoying what they are reading. Enjoy what you are reading.
Yes.
And I think that will help. The one thing that we are forgetting, or that's not being talked about a lot, in the whole 81% of children not being, it's a lot of that are children who are not English and Afrikaans speaking, you know what I mean? So it's a whole lot of children who are African language speakers.
Right.
And they have to read these languages that they don't understand. That's why they don't read with meaning. That is why it's very important for every child to enjoy stories and education in a language that they understand best. That's why as Nalibali, we produce all these stories that are written in African languages for children to enjoy.
So do you believe that if children were tested in their own language, that the stats might be higher, that there might be a higher percentage of children who can read for meaning?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, I believe so. I really do believe so. Because listen, it's grade four. It's grade four children. So, and then here you look at this, what we have in our country where children are taught from grade one to grade three in their own language. You know, everything from content to language, everything is taught in Setswana and Sizulu and so on. And then they transition from there in grade four. And they have to be taught in English. So it's because now they don't understand. This is a new thing for them. Right. They're just moving from being taught in Setswana, in isiZulu, in isiXhosa. And then all of a sudden, they are thrust into this language that they don't understand. They are brought into this because language is also culture. They are brought into this whole other culture that they don't understand. So I really, really do believe that. It's not something that I'm making up. Research has shown that over and over, that when children are being taught in their home languages or they are being spoken in their home languages, then they understand. Because, I mean, listen, just make an example of you as, I don't know what your home language is, but can you imagine if you have to be tested in a language that is not yours?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think about using any language, while I might be able to say the words, I also would
hear
what I was saying.
Yes. I mean, you may understand a little bit of isiZulu or Setswana then there, but if I have to sit down with you and test you and say, Corinne, okay, you know, you wouldn't know what I'm talking about.
So I have been reading a lot about this government focus on this problem, and I do believe that they are looking at it and they are looking at a plan. I'm not sure if you know more than we know about that. Tell me a little bit about what you think government is doing.
So the government is looking at introducing mother tongue-based bilingual education, where, you know, they want children to, especially from grade one to grade three, being taught in home languages, they want to make it up to grade four, and then maybe, you know, go further on and for children to be taught mathematics in their home languages and so on. And we've actually seen that happen in the Eastern Cape, where matrix for the first time have written mathematics in isiXhosa and Sesotho, and the percentage has been higher. They passed way more than the ones who wrote in English. You know, it's not a new thing in South Africa for mother tongue-based bilingual education. English and Afrikaans have done that. The children who are taught in English and Afrikaans, they are taught in their mother tongue. And you know, they pass, they do very well because they are being taught in their mother tongue. So right. For African languages, it's not like it's something that's going to be tried for the first time in our country. We've always had English and Afrikaans being mother tongue-based bilingual education. You know, because people will come up with, what will children do with their languages if they are taught in isiXhosa and so on? The very same thing that the Afrikaans children do in their languages is the very same thing that children who are being taught in African languages will do.
Yes.
Because I think the African-speaking children, they go out and become successful and they've been taught in their languages. So it can happen with that. You know, and his research has also shown that it's easy for children to transition perfectly if they have the foundation of their home languages. Corinne, you know, when we, unfortunately, we mainly focused on reading. And I mean, it's good, but it's very unfortunate that we have left a major part of the African culture out by focusing more on just reading and not focusing on the orality of literature. Because literature is not just the text, it's also hearing, it's the orality of it. There are so many households in South Africa that are headed by grandmothers who are not able to read and write. But what do you say to them when you talk about reading only? So you are leading them out of the whole ecosystem of promoting literacy. Tell the children stories, because I believe that children need to hear the stories. Children need to see the text as well. It's not just one that is better than the other. So the orality of literature has been unfortunately left out of the reading promotion campaigns and all that. And I think that is very important for us to bring all that together in promoting literacy and saying, we see you, grandma, we know you are trying, you know, telling those children stories in isiZulu, in Setswana, in Xitsonga. We see you, you are part of this ecosystem of bringing literature to the children as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, it also makes me think about how research has shown that even if you can't read the story, if you have a book in front of you and you make up a story as you turn the pages, children often do that because they can't read.
Yes.
Making up a story, I think that's something we sometimes forget.
You know, there was a project that I was involved in many years ago through Center for the Book. It was called First Words in Print Project. So we were producing books and we were working with families and ECD centers and, you know, some schools and churches and clinics, and they will take these books and take them there. And we'll go into these families. And I remember going into the families where, you know, there was grandmothers who were the matriarch and, you know, the younger parents were out in the cities working, and the children were being looked after by grandmothers, and we took the books in there. And we had some wordless picture books, because you remember also it's about, you know, the culture. You need to understand the culture of the people. And the grandmother was saying, you see, I never want my grandchildren to see me not being able to read to them because I cannot read.
Right.
That takes away my authority as the matriarch in the family, that there's something that I cannot do and I cannot be seen not being able to do that. With wordless picture books, now I can read to them. I can create a story with them. There's no text that intimidates me. If it's just pictures, then I'm able to create a story with my grandchildren. We sit down together and we create our own story. So the wordless stories were so important. You will ask them to send you the story with the pictures only. And you go to another household and it's different from that household. That's the beauty of the wordless picture books, that you can have this one book, but it can create 10 different stories because they created their own story.
And then I love it that the child can then go on and read the story as well, you know, read it, and like hold it and show it to their little siblings or their friends and say, I'm going to tell you a story now. Also, the power of it is that it encourages children to see themselves as storytellers.
Yeah, I actually remember there was a time when I think I was in middle school. I was reading this book. It was for the first time that we had a book that was prescribed, and it was an African story, and it was from Ghana. And I know how much I loved that story. I know how much I loved that story. The way the author described the African market, I'll never forget. The author describe the African market in very vivid, and you know, and I made it up in my head. And every time when I went to market, I always thought that if this is not the market he was talking about, the one that he was talking about is nothing like that. And I remember as an adult, as I was working, I went to Venda and I saw this big market in Venda, and I screamed and I said, this is the market that I heard 20 years ago, that I read about 20 years ago. The author described this very market from a book that I read 20 years ago.
And that's the power of words to bring something alive. So you actually, you'd seen it through those words.
That's what stories can do to you, you know, to a child. That's what this, the imagination, you can imagine anything that you want to imagine. We can create your whole story inside of your head because of just the words or the things that you hear about the story.
Yeah, and absolutely. I think about the young children, because you're obviously focusing primarily on your early learning. What age do you start from? Is it from like 2 or from...
You know, we start from birth to 6 and then 6 to 12.
So you think it's important, obviously, for children who are not even walking yet to just hear stories, to be involved in the world of books and reading?
Oh, yes. It's very, very important for children to hear the words. I mean, that's how they learn as well, to speak. You know, the babies, they will learn to speak from hearing you, the mother or the parent or whoever, the caregiver, speaking the words. That's how they will learn to start. So, I mean, the best place for them to learn about hearing the stories. I mean, we've got board books. There are some books that are made from cloth that the children can, you know, see pictures. You know, like the challenge that we have, I look at what we have created in our country where now, you know, we want to say, oh, children are not reading. Oh, we go to high schoolers. What do you do with a high schooler who doesn't have the culture of reading? You know, when you haven't started them when they were in preschool or they were at home and so on. Now you want to say to an 18-year-old that you need to start reading now. You know, I'm sure you can get one or two of them, but it's not something that we can revolutionize and say, you need to get 18-year-olds to. They are gone.
Yeah, they're gone. And
they're,
you know,
gone.
It speaks to a lot of parents, because the biggest question we get sent at the Book Tree is, how do I get my child to read more? parents who at their wits' ends, and often it does happen after, there's two ages it happens at. One is sort of after the grade four point where the children suddenly have to read more advanced books and children get left behind because they're just, their reading is not at that level. And then the next stage it happens is going into high school. And that is also a problem because what happens is the children don't see the value in reading anymore. They're on their phones or their friends are not reading. And you obviously do get the children who love reading. And I always try and look at those children and think, well, is there maybe a later stage you can get them back? Sometimes when they've turned 16, they get a little bit older, then they get into the series, those, you know, the books like that. But I think it really is to try and just keep your children from the moment they are born, having books around, making it a part of your routine. It's your life. It's what you do. You tell stories, you read. Certainly that might not be the answer to everything, but it's a good beginning.
Yeah. I mean, make reading your way of life. That's what basically that we are saying. Just make it a way of life that you, you know, because also children learn from what they see as adults doing. You know what? If you are going to be on your phone the whole day as an adult, your child is going to think that that is such an amazing thing. If you are going to be reading a book, I mean, I will make another example about my life growing up as well. Like I was saying to you that I grew up in, you know, South Africa in the 80s and 90s where it was just political violence around us and all that stuff. And there were no books at home. There were no libraries. We didn't have a library. Yeah. Let me tell you what I saw in my mom besides her telling us stories. I saw my mother reading the Bible. And when my mother was reading the Bible, my mother would stay in that element of reading. And for me, as this little, I didn't know what the Bible was. But I knew that taking a book and sitting down must be so enjoyable because you couldn't touch my mom when she was reading her Bible. You know, I didn't know what the Bible was about. And so I just knew it was a book. I just knew it was a book.
But you mirror that and you think, well, that's the thing. This loved person in your life is giving time and energy and enjoying it. So that is, I think it's a huge part of the whole puzzle of how to get children reading. To end off, I have two questions. One is obviously, I love your work. And I always look at the Forgotten Scientist, story of Saul Sithole. And I do wonder, like, if you had to say, what kind of books do we need more of in South Africa? If we were speaking to authors, people who want to write books for children, you specialize in biographies. I know you've also got a new book out. You can tell me a little bit about it with Gregory McCormack about his life as a dancer. I think it's wonderful work that you're doing those biographies. Do you think we need more of those?
A whole lot. Children need both fiction and nonfiction. And I think that in our country, we have focused more on fiction for children. And I know it's important, but we need a whole lot of nonfiction stories for children in our country because you know, the nonfiction that we have in our country is adult books. So I have just made it my mission. I said, I want to write for children. I want children to understand that there's this other side of this other people, you know, and writing in a way that they understand, even one language that's mild for them to understand, you know, to enjoy the stories. You know, I have this background of oral storytelling. Even through my biographies, I always bring the element of orality to it. A story, I make it fun. I don't know if you read my books, there's always this.
Yes.
There's something about it being, about my books having that element of bringing the fun part to the stories, the way I write.
And I also think you literally do bring it to life. You give interesting details so that it's not just a history lesson or, you know, just facts that you're giving. You actually make it come alive so that I think the readers can see themselves in those people. They kind of suddenly imagine, well, you know, I enjoy science or I enjoy dancing. I could be that person.
Yeah, exactly that. You can be that person. So make it in a way that it's not boring because it's like, oh, biographies are so boring. People are going to tell us about their lives and all that. No, you make for children. You know, I always say to people that, you know, writing for children, it's not easy. So difficult. It's the most difficult form of writing.
I agree with you. Everyone says, oh, that's easy. It's short. It's a quick book.
Yeah.
I think people don't realize that because it is a shorter book, you have fewer words to put across
such. Yeah. Because it's very short. You don't have the privilege of text. You know, the other thing about children is that you need to get them from the very beginning. If you can't get them there, you are not getting them back. They are gone.
They're gone. I agree with you. If they don't like your story, they don't give you the, they don't say to themselves, oh, well, you know, it's such a nice book.
Not kids. If ever there was cancel culture, it came with children. They will cancel it right away. We are done with it. That's it.
That's it. So they're trying to give you another opportunity. If you bought them once, it will stick. That dog is boring. You don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, that's so true. Lerato, thank you so much for this chat. I'm going to end off with just asking you, people who are listening, if they want to get involved with Nali Bali, what do you suggest?
So we have a lot of reading clubs that we have established in wherever you are. And you can get involved in reading club, register as a Nali Bali reading club and we get our resources, or you can go register, you know, go and volunteer at an ECD center and tell children stories and have fun with those children in their home languages. Can also volunteer your stories and send your stories through to us. We'll publish them for you. You'll be a published author. You'll be on our website, Nali Bali, and so on. We keep writing. And Corinne, before we go anywhere, I also want to tell you, we're talking about my recent book about Greg Makoma. It's actually not very recent. I've got a new book coming out next month. Jacana is publishing my new biography for children about Oma Katrina. You know, the story of Oma Katrina, the 91-year-old grandmother in Upington, who's the only mother tongue speaker of her new language, one of the Khoisan languages. So it's a beautiful book with pictures. It's a biography. It's for children and it's coming out next month.
Wonderful. I'm can't wait to read it. What's it called?
It's called The Golden Girl, The Story of Katrina Esso.
The Golden Girl. Okay, well, we're going to definitely review that on our site, so look out for it. How do you find these people?
Oh my God, I've known her for 9 years now. I've worked with her over and over. I go out and find South African stories. That's what I do. I find South African stories that are fascinating.
Thank you again so, so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. You are doing the most amazing work and well done to you and your whole team.
Thank you so much, Corinne. We really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's time to dive into the pages of the book review.
Every time I'm going to focus on a couple of books, I always try and feature at least two new releases and then one book that I think is really worth going back and reading or going to your library and finding at the very back of the shelves. You know how they have those books? Sometimes they're a bit dusty and they haven't been taken out for a year. But those are the books that you should be looking for your children. So the first book is a new release. It is called Who Ate Steve? It's by Susanna Lloyd and it's illustrated by Kate Hindley. And it is pure picture book entertainment. I love it. It's written by a British author, and she has this lovely sense of silly and quirky humor, very similar to John Clarkson. He wrote the book, I Want My Hat Back. And it's a classic. It's got that kind of detective sense, trying to find out who ate Steve. So the story starts off with two characters. Marcel is a bird, a big bird. And Steve is a worm, a small. Wait a second. Where is Steve? Steve has disappeared. Do you think Marcel knows anything about where he might have gotten to? You can just hear in the way that she's written this book, there's so many opportunities to talk with your children as you read it, to have dramatic pauses, to point at the pictures, and to look at the way that the text is written, because the real power of this book is actually in the combination of the text and the illustrations. The text written in different sizes, fonts, capitals, highlights, and it makes it a really great read-aloud experience. I'll read you one section so you can get a feeling for it. Marcel, that is not the sort of behavior we expect in our book. I'm not going to tell you again, Marcel. You bring Steve back down at once. Oh, good. Right. Now, where was I? Ah, yes. As I was saying, Marcel, I've got my eye on you. And then, of course, what does Marcel do? Oh, how disappointing. Look at the children, Marcel. You are spoiling the lovely book. You're not just letting yourself down. You're letting everybody down. Marcel, this is your final warning. And the humor of it is really brought across. So even though you might feel like it's this cross voice of the narrator, the expression on Marcel's face with his huge eyes as if to say, what have I done? I've done nothing wrong. In the end, of course, it gets turned around as something bigger than Marcel comes along and tries to eat him. You'll have to read the book to find out what happens. Who Ate Steve by Susanna Lloyd and illustrated by Kate Hindley, and the publisher is Nosy Crow. It is perfect for age 2 to, I would say, 5 years old, 6 years old, depending on their reading levels. Just buy it. Your kids will love it. Who remembers finding a series of books that you absolutely loved aged around 10, 11, 12. When I found a series of books that I could just get into, it was my whole reason for existing at that age. I think I was into the Sweet Valley High books. Well, a new range of books that seems to be getting children from around 11 plus are the drama series of Lottie Brooks. If you've been into exclusives, you would have seen all the ribbons and banting and posters all around her books. So when I saw this, I actually realized I've never heard of the Lottie Brooks stories. And I'm normally quite skeptical when it comes to heavily publicized books. It's normally because when publishing machines get put into action, they often promote books that, while they might be good, they push them to a level that is beyond. So you end up buying the books without actually reviewing them individually and seeing if they actually are any good. But I would say that when it comes to the range of Lottie books, it's completely warranted. For the kind of reader who loves the Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging, the Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the Dork Diary series, this is the perfect book. It's really about that heavily self-involved time when you are in your tweens and early teens. I mean, aren't those actually the most self-obsessed times of your life? Although, lately, I could argue that menopause is the most self-obsessed time as you become less interested in other people's dramas. And I think you just get by dealing with your own changing body and moods. But anyway, enough about me. Let's go back to the teens and the tweens. So in the first book, The Extremely Embarrassing Life of Lottie Brooks, she's an 11 and three-quarter-year-old schoolgirl about to start high school. Without any friends or glamorous swishy hair, she's just discovered she's too flat-chested to wear a bra. Oh, the horrors. As the series progresses, Lottie goes through all sorts of friendship, school, and boyfriend dramas. And when she eventually gets a boyfriend called Daniel, they actually have such a wholesome relationship. She says, no kissing with tongues, ew. So you don't have to worry about exposing your tweens to anything too advanced. It's all quite appropriate for a young tween reader. In the latest book that I was sent to review, which is called The Majorly Awkward BFF Dramas of Lottie Brooks, Lottie is having major friendship issues as she tries to juggle having a boyfriend with keeping her friends happy. What she finds is that a new boyfriend and a new dog means that she has little time for anyone else and leaving all her best friends pretty upset. And she has to deal with one of the girls in her friendship group, a former mean girl called Amber. Amber keeps sabotaging Lottie and trying to make her look bad in front of the others. Because Amber's parents are going through a divorce, everyone feels bad for her. But it also means that she gets away with being mean to Lottie, and no one wants to tell her off. This kind of tween and teen friendship issue is just so common, and it actually made me feel upset just reading it. Why do girls do this? And why do so many girls follow the queen bee so blindly? I think that the writer, Katie Kirby, really gets into the conversations that tweens have with each other, which can range from deep and emotional stuff to literally the most obsessive facts about their latest pop star crush or the things they ate for dinner. The Lottie Brooks series is perfect for children who are reluctant readers or who haven't really gotten into the habit of reading. Some of the reviews say things like, my daughter couldn't put it down and read it in 2 days. She read it breakfast, walking downstairs, tea time, and in the bath. Another review says, my 9-year-old daughter devoured it in 2 nights, and all I could hear from her was giggling and the occasional, Mum, listen to this. This is so me. And this last review says, my 12-year-old reluctant reader took the book, read 100 pages in 1 night, and proclaimed it the best book I've ever read. So there you go. This is really a worthwhile book to try with your age 10 plus. Another plus factor about the style of the book is it's written as a diary. So everything is dated and it takes place over a couple of months. So for example, it'll say Thursday the 24th of July, 12:32 p.m. OMG, I'm totally bald above my eyes. My forehead is just a giant expanse of nothingness. Everyone at school will laugh at me tomorrow and I'll get another awful nickname like Lottie No Eyebrows or Massive Forehead Girl or something even worse. But I can't think of any clever eyebrow puns right now because I'm so stressed out. The only good news is that Amber is also on her way around with her makeup bag to try and rectify the situation. 13:45 p.m. OMG. I look a bit like an alien. Or a worm or a thumb, I moan to the girls. I personally think you look more like a beluga whale, said Amber. And then next to the diary entries, she has little stick figure drawings where she's illustrated the disastrous things that happened to her. Like, OMG, OMG. And then you've got Amber saying, now lower the tweezers to the floor slowly and no one needs to get hurt. She's got a picture of herself meditating, manifesting new eyebrows. I just love the sense of humor, and it really does work very well together with the text. So I think this is a great book to buy for your reluctant readers, for your new readers, for your tweens. If you want to find out more about Katie Kirby, she is a writer and illustrator. She lives in the UK. She was working in advertising, and once she had her children, she decided to start a blog called Hurrah for Gin. And that's a great title, about the hardships and the humor of trying to be a parent who can do it all. It's a real and humorous account of parenting young children sans the sugarcoating. Now for a book that I'm absolutely loving, that I found at my local library. I love looking for books that are kind of in the back shelves that no one's really been taking out for a while. I think the last time this one was taken out was in 2022. It's called Singing for Mrs. Pettigrew, A Story Maker's Journey. And it's written by the master storyteller, Michael Mopurgo. He's the author of those classics like War Horse, Born to Run, and The Butterfly Lion. In this book, he shares his storytelling journey and the inspiration for his writing. It's part memoir, part short stories, part writing manifesto. Michael Mopurgo has written around 130 books. His first book was published in 1974. And he held the title of Children's Laureate from 2003 to 2005. Michael was actually first a soldier. He trained at the prestigious Sandhurst College, and then he settled into teaching. And he only discovered his love of writing later in life when he was a teacher. He also founded a charity called Farms for City Children with his wife, Claire, which basically allowed city children to go and experience the countryside. In this beautiful storybook, he shares his process of story making and storytelling. The book gathers together stories of his life, interspersed with stories that he has made up, that he's telling. And what we get from this is an engaging insight into the actual craft of telling stories. I think he's one of the most natural storytellers that I know. And when you read his stories and you understand why he was inspired to write the stories he did, you start to see what the skill is in creating a story. And he actually talks about that. Basically, he says that we are all storytellers, but we have to find the story that we have to tell. So he writes about how he found his stories when he moved to rural Devon. And by staying in one place and truly getting to know it, he learned to dream up stories about a place that he knew deeply and loved. Because he was a boarding school boy, he had never really felt settled throughout his life. So his advice reads, first immerse yourself in the world around you. Become a part of it, and then you'll be able to write. Don't pretend. Tell your tale. Speak with your own voice. We are what we write, I think, even more than we are what we read. This is a wonderful story to read, and you can dip in and out of it. I would recommend it for ages 11 plus. It can be read as a writing manifesto to help you get your own inspiration for your own storybooks. And for children just to delve into a magical world. One of my favorite stories that I've read so far, because I've not finished the book, is about a little boy who hears a story about a unicorn. And he lives in a war-torn country and how he learns to believe in unicorns. It's really beautifully written and it's so worthwhile taking out from your library or investing in your own copy. Thank you so much for listening to our first podcast as we spoke to the director of Nali Bali, Lerato Trock. I hope you enjoyed the book reviews of Who Ate Steve, the majorly awkward BFF dramas of Lottie Brooks, and Singing for Mrs. Pettigrew. Please do sign up and follow us. Our next podcast will feature an interview with the author of the Trixie series, Lorianne Preston, plus a look at the best books for children with ADHD or dyslexia. Until then, happy reading.